Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. A reminder, everyone, that we continue to Zoom on the night before, so this is Sunday evening. So if something should happen Sunday night, we'll be discussing it on Tuesday. Well, just a couple of days left. We have begun this radio show every single day since March, except for two, with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. I remember being riveted when he spoke. And I realized after he was sort of escorted out of the White House that I needed to capture that act of patriotism, the ability to talk truth to power. The man who told his father, "Don't worry, Papa, it will be all right." And of course, as we've come to expect, until Donald Trump is removed, nothing is all right. So the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, have it weighing in your heart and your head as you exercise the franchise. And I'm assuming that by now, a lot of you already have. Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free, free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry, I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
So this is our last Rethink the Week before some kind of an election will be happening on Tuesday. Let me introduce my great panel of guests. We've actually added more than normal, but this really demands more than normal. We have two professors. We have Professor Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University. He is a civic scholar and a presidential scholar. He has a blog, nhpoliticalcapital.com, and you can hear him regularly on NHPR, New Hampshire Public Radio. Welcome back, Dean.
Hi, Ernie. Good to be with you.
It's a pleasure. We haven't talked to him in a while, but I believe he's a candidate for the state legislature. He is also the chair of the government department at Dartmouth College. Russ Muirhead. Let me welcome Professor Muirhead back to the program. How are you, Russ?
Great to be here, Arnie. Thank you. And I tell you, if we get a couple more professors, we could change a light bulb.
Yeah, exactly. But I'm excited that you're running. I think that's terrific. You're actually gonna love it. You're gonna love it.
Oh, I hope so. Thank you. It's great to hear.
I miss it to this day. I miss it. All right. Now our two non-professors, we're going to make real diversité. We have Rick Newman. Rick Newman was a former legislator. He is currently a lobbyist. And I guess I would describe you as a lobbyist for small business. Is that correct, Rick?
Pretty much. Correct.
Pretty much. All right. And Rick Newman lobbies in the state of New Hampshire. And we have had him join us numerous times. Welcome back to the program, Rick.
Thank you, Arnie. Good to be here.
And our fourth but not last talker is a lawyer. He is an immigration attorney. His name is Ron Abramson. He is joining us as he's done on many occasions and was a supporter when I first met you, Ron, of Bernie Sanders, and a supporter of Elizabeth Warren. And now all we're doing is keeping our fingers crossed about what will happen on Tuesday, because this isn't even a partisan choice. I think this is a life and death choice. So let me welcome Ron to the program. How are you, Ron?
That sums up the last 100 years nicely, Arnie.
I actually put something on my Facebook page. I woke up at about 2 o'clock in the morning and I wrote, a Trump win equals death cubed. Climate change denial, COVID-19 denial, or armed marauders encouraged. I'm gonna start with you, Russ. What we know about this president is that he doesn't do policy. He actually doesn't even do politics for that matter. I think he does theft and lying, but he doesn't really do that either because politics has some sort of respect for the process. But what he has done is deny science. And whether that's COVID-19, whether that's climate change, that is problematic for the last 4 years, but it would be horrific going forward for the next 4 years. But my comment about armed marauders being encouraged reflects what we saw happening in Texas, where there was a Biden-Harris bus going down the highway and a group of Trump supporters in their pickup trucks with Trump signs and American flags flying basically tried to get the bus off the road. And instead of being sort of appalled by this behavior, Trump tweeted out, "I love Texas." So as that is my sort of opening salvo, this election feels so much more frightening than anything I've ever imagined. I knew that, you know, I might die of something. I didn't realize that it would be because of a political choice that it might actually move up the date.
Yeah, I mean, to have a president who celebrates, you know, not just celebrates violence, celebrates mob, it's halting. I mean, when I saw that he tweeted out, "I love Texas," it's one of these moments where I just can't keep reading. And he denies science and he tweets like that because this is a president who has no capacity. He doesn't care whether people die because he doesn't know how to care about people. And it sounds elemental, but you know, this is, as his niece, I think, accurately sized it up, this is a man who's never been loved by another person and who doesn't have the capacity to love any other person. And his emotional range as a result is so profoundly damaged and distorted that that he can bring himself to celebrate the kind of action and encourage the kind of action that would result in violence and death. It means absolutely nothing to this guy.
As I'm hearing what you say about the fact that he was never loved and this idea, and now it's become sort of our collective burden, his emotional fragility, which is sort of problematic. I guess I'm gonna turn to you, Rick. But were his supporters never loved? You see, no. I think what Russ is saying is so important because he clearly shows that everyone is expendable. He clearly shows Rick that it's all about him. He makes fun of his supporters. He actually is almost inviting death. There was a story that they actually did a look at his super spreading event and how many people actually, you know, contracted COVID as a result of his super spreading political events. How many people may have died as a result of it? And I hear what Russ is saying about this incredibly damaged human being who unfortunately we call president. But I am trying to figure out how 42 to 45% of the American electorate is either equally damaged, don't recognize this incredibly flawed human being, or invite this kind of violence against them. I mean, it's not just violence against us, it's also, Rick, violence against them.
Yeah, and I think, you know, two things. I mean, one, you said it's all about him, and that's absolutely true. We see that in everything that he does. And I desperately tried to understand the people that I know, that I've been in the legislature with, that I've spent 40 years arguing politics with on the other side, but always respected, and trying to understand, how the hell can you support Donald Trump? I understood how you supported Reagan. I understood how you supported Bush. I didn't agree with you, but I can't understand. But now it seems like I'm beginning to slowly understand, for a lot of them, it's all about them. Well, I liked what he did with the court. Oh, I made money on the tax cuts. You know, I'm in this business and the regulations were lifted. It helped me. They've stopped looking at the overall benefit of all of us and they're totally tuned into it helps me, so therefore I'm okay with it. The second thing is to get to Russell's point about the encouragement and about his tweet. And then we talked just briefly about this a moment ago. Right now, as we speak at 4:15 on Sunday afternoon, the Garden State Parkway in New Jersey is shut down by a similar action being taken that was taken in Texas by Trump supporters who have put together a car caravan and think it's okay, encouraged by the actions and the comments of what Trump did yesterday about Texas. They've literally shut down the Garden State Parkway. Now, number one, that's not good politics. It's also bad for public safety. Now, a lot of those people on the Garden State Parkway have driven it many times, are probably on their way back home to Pennsylvania, and some of them are going to be voting on Tuesday. And you know, I was joking earlier with someone, you know, did Matt Maurer leave New Hampshire campaigning to go back to New Jersey to show him how to shut down a highway because, you know, he was involved with the Christie thing. But I don't understand. I don't understand that action. But clearly, that's encouraged by Donald Trump.
So Dean, as I'm listening to Russ about, you know, the unloved and what happened in Texas, and then I hear Rick talk about the New Jersey Turnpike, what is terrifying to me is that there is an interesting focus here. And the focus is, it was the Biden-Harris. Although it was Texas, it was focused on those liberals in the bus. New Jersey is a liberal state. It will go blue. So the idea of shutting down something called the New Jersey Turnpike is a perfect action against a blue state. And I see what we're getting is, Dean, is a sort of ramping up of what is going to happen, not on Tuesday, but on Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, no matter who wins. And that is really, this is just a taste, I think, of the behavior that we're going to see, because they see if he loses, it's about revenge. And if he wins, it's going to be about another form of revenge because he won. Because he will encourage this behavior against states that did not vote for him, Dean Spiliotis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, there's some polling data that I saw over the weekend that said that something like 80% of Americans are concerned about violence in conjunction with the results of the election. And, you know, there's issues of actually voting in person and voter intimidation. And we've talked a little bit about that in the past. I've seen a number of media, stories in the media about militias that are training and drilling in anticipation of being out on election day. I think everybody has, you know, concerns. We're just going to have to see how it plays out. But yeah, certainly there are going to be some unhappy folks regardless of the outcome. And I think, you know, Rick's sense of where Trump's coalition is, you know, I've heard other people ask me, how can 42 or 44, whatever percent of Americans support him? It is this coalition pieced together of people whose economic self-interest drives them to support him and overlook all the other stuff for whom that's their priority, tax policy or what have you. It's another group of people, particularly evangelicals, who have entered into a transactional relationship with him because they want conservative judges and they want to overturn Roe v. Wade. And then the third element is white working class folks who have a sense of grievance that they've been left behind, that others have gotten wealthy and they have not shared in that prosperity, and that in some sense they're looked down upon by economic elites and academic elites and reporters who go to elite colleges. And there was a real kind of class warfare cultural component to it. And he's managed to kind of piece those groups together. And I think each group has a different relationship with him, but they all kind of serve his purposes of putting together a coalition. Now, whether or not that's going to be enough for him to win a second time, that is where he gathers most of his strength.
So, Ron, he's already sort of told us what he's going to do on Tuesday. But of course, it's not a surprise. But he basically says, you know, if I am winning on Tuesday night, I've won. You know, whatever happens after midnight on Tuesday is of no consequence, because if I am winning on Tuesday night, I have won. And I saw an interesting statement from National Public Radio, and they said that they're going to follow the AP standard. And here is the AP standard. Only when AP is fully confident a race has been won, defined most simply as the moment a trailing candidate no longer has any path to victory, will we make a call. And of course, we heard Axios report this just on Sunday. The New York Times has reported this. What they haven't done is basically say what the AP says. Candidates don't get to call their race. They don't get to pick the winner, let alone sort of manipulate the election. And yet that isn't what we heard with Axios, and that isn't what we heard with the New York Times, which in some ways gets me so frustrated, because Donald Trump is so good at manipulating the media to basically frame his agenda.
That's exactly right. The New York Times story made that sound like it was a legitimate campaign strategy versus the potential subversion of an actual Democratic election result. And, you know, there are many of us who have been frustrated, and some of whom, like me, canceled their New York Times subscription after all these years because they just can't they can't seem to call anything what it is in this administration. They have solid reporting of facts and terrible framing of headlines and editorials. Oh. And, you know, election night's going to come down to two issues. There's going to be which way the certain states break and by how much. Will there be narrow enough margins for any strained, plausible challenge? And if you think about it, what if everything was inverted? I mean, what would the president do if he was slightly ahead and then there were all these ballots yet to be counted versus if he was slightly behind and there were all these ballots left to be counted? Since this is a person devoid of any guiding principle based on their life's action, we know it's all transactional. We know it's all situational. And one of the things that bothers me as a lawyer is that there are still legions of lawyers willing to put forward these, you know, not only bad faith challenges, but challenges to the very cornerstones of our Constitution and our democratic system. I mean, there is a litany of voter suppression litigation happening as we speak. I wouldn't be surprised if there's some other decision that comes down tonight, tomorrow morning. And
there will be in Texas. Supreme Court is going to the Supreme Court. There will be.
The Supreme Court already ruled today. They rejected the challenge. The question is whether it's going to the U.S. Supreme Court. Is that what you mean?
Yes, I'm at the U.S. Supreme Court. The Texas Supreme Court unanimously basically sort of supported the voter rights opportunity.
You're talking about the 100,000 ballots in Houston.
Right. Thank you. So let me, Russ, so that's the other thing. Again, I want to go back to the media and the framing because this is so important, Russ. And that is that sort of, for example, what happened in Texas where a group of discontent Republicans challenged these drive-through voting, what is it, over 100,000, as you pointed out, in Houston. And the completely Republican Supreme Court of Texas unanimously basically threw it out and said, no, these votes count. Now, here's the problem. This is not a Democratic win, Russ. This is a democracy win, Russ. This is a voter win, Russ. And I have seen headline after headline that refers to when these things are successful, that the votes are respected, that we are going to count these votes and not throw them in, that this is a Democratic win. This also aids and abets the division and what is being fostered by Donald Trump. And I am wild about this.
It's a fascinating thing that we have now a major party, one of the oldest democratic institutions in the world, if you date it back to whatever, 1858 or something, adopting a strategy of disenfranchisement.
Yes.
It's given up on the strategy of persuasion. and it's so stupid. I mean, if you happen to be a conservative, if you happen to be a Republican for whatever reason, this is such a stupid strategy. This is not the path to a victorious future. There are so many, Latinx voters who have, who lean conservative for all kinds of reasons. There are so many Black voters who have conservative views about this, that, or the other thing. And because of the hatred in that party and because of this, the white nationalism that the white nationalist ideal that it's pursuing, and because of these strategies that you're just discussing of disenfranchisement, and they're blocking out their own future. Never seen anything like it. I mean, one of the reasons I really want a blowout on Tuesday is not because I, as a partisan, not just because I was a partisan, want 57 Democratic senators who can do all sorts of stuff that I think is good. It's because I want to definitively defeat Trumpism and disenfranchisement. I want to defeat white nationalism. I want to teach Republicans that this is not the path to victory. I want to teach young people who are conservatives that this is not the guy to copy. And there's nothing like a catastrophic blowout to drive home that lesson.
Except, so Dean, I have some interesting numbers in front of me. Number of polling places closed since the five Republican-appointed justices on the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act in 2013. 750 in Texas, 320 in Arizona, 214 in Georgia, 126 in Louisiana, 96 in Mississippi, 72 in Alabama, 29 in North Carolina, for a total of 1,688 polling places. So you listen to what Russ just said, you listen to what Ron just said, you know how many appeals there are going through, that that Republicans have not only embraced this, but that we've turned the vote into partisan action. And that is what's so scary. To close a polling place should offend everyone. And yet look who aided and abetted. It wasn't the Supreme, it was the Supreme Court that did this. See, that's what's to me so terrifying. And when you see this number, and then you look at who are the newly appointed Supreme Court justices, I am looking at a Supreme Court that I am going to be terrified of for decades to come, Dean.
Yeah, you know, and this is, I certainly agree, this is the worst we've ever seen, you know, this kind of overt attempt to sort of shape access to the ballot. It's been going on for a long time. You go back to several election cycles at least, and I remember some very heated discussions about the number of polling places in various cities and whether or not they were sufficient to meet voter demand. You know, interestingly enough, it seems as though waiting on these long lines that we see everywhere has become almost a badge of honor among some folks. I mean, people understand what's going on. It's unfortunate, but the whole idea of litigating around the vote, even though it's always been part of the process, it's now become just part of the strategic handbook that people use to block access to the ballot. I mean, I've never, as I said, I've observed it for years, but never this overtly, certainly in the post civil rights movement era, to see it so openly discussed. And, you know, I saw today on television, one of Trump's advisors saying that, you know, well, election night, we think President Trump will be at about 280 or more electoral votes, basically implying that, like, that's the cutoff point is election night. And then they're just going to litigate the hell out of everything after election. Now, you know, I think in some sense there are going to be opportunities. I think the courts will side, I think, in some instances to block that kind of thinking, but there's no guarantee. We saw in the earlier opinions out of the Supreme Court with Justice Gorsuch and Kavanaugh and Alito saying, you know, we're not going to interfere right now. However,
tipping their hand,
we're not precluding taking a look after November 3rd. So we just don't know what's going to happen.
So you made an interesting comment, and Rick, it took me 14 seconds to vote. Okay, that's how long. I mean, I did it absentee, but I could hand it in. I did it directly. I didn't go through the post office, whatever. So I was on the line outside the clerk's office, and I've never had to wait more than 15 minutes. How is a 7-hour line and an 8-hour line and a 10-hour line not a poll tax? And the reason I say that is poor people have to work. They don't get that day off. So it might be, you know, it might be something that feels stature enhancing to wait online for 8 hours. But if I have kids, if I have a job, you know what's happening to me? It's costing me money. It is costing me money. I might lose my job. This is no longer acceptable that in certain shishi places, it turns out, some people have the privilege of waiting 10 or 15 minutes. And then in strategic places, whether it's Milwaukee or whether it's Detroit or whether it's somewhere else, people have to wait online for 8, 10, and 12 hours. How is that not perceived as a poll tax since we don't give people election day off? And this means that for those individuals, voting has financial consequences. I've never heard that argued. And after listening to all of you guys, it suddenly was like a ka-ching. This is another part of the problem. Who gets hurt, not only with the waste of time, but with the financial complications of wasting that time, Rick?
Well, and look at, you mentioned Milwaukee. Can you believe Milwaukee during the primary had one place to vote?
Yes.
One place. The city of Portsmouth's got 5 places. You know, we get 25,000 people in Portsmouth. I think Milwaukee's got 800,000. I mean, it's absolutely outrageous. But, you know, it really does go back, and Dean's right. It's been going on for years, and everybody's tries to take a strategic advantage when they can. It's certainly much worse now than ever, and it comes from the top. You know, when Donald Trump looks at the country, he doesn't look at the country. He looks at it in terms of red and blue. You know, when he won't give aid, when he says, I'm not going to give aid to the blue states, to bail out the blue states in the pandemic. I just looked it up. 2.4 million people in New York voted for Donald Trump. 2.4 million people who are hurting or unemployed, who have pre-existing conditions. He's telling them, like Ford did in 1976, Ford City dropped dead. You know, 4.5 million people voted for Donald Trump in California, but it's a blue state. So he refused to give wildfire money to the state of California until the press blew it up, and then he was forced to do it. But that's the way he views the world. He views it in terms of, if Alabama needs help, I'm there for you. If New Jersey needs help, I'll shut down the Garden State. I'll have my supporters encourage them to shut down the Garden State Parkway.
It's shocking. So last, before we go to a break, so Russ, I was looking around for who has the best sort of, you know, voting system in the world, the best election system in the world. And so I was Googled and I found an article from 2015. And of course, it doesn't surprise you that the system that is the most valued was New Zealand. Duh, we kind of met this. But let me just read you something from that article from 2015, because it was so frightening. It says, we in the US tend to assume, however awful we might think our politicians are, that our political system is excellent. This is 2015. Constitution held in high esteem. Democrats and Republicans like to pay lip service to the genius of the founders. But our system, combining two powerful legislative bodies with a strong executive, is pretty rare internationally. Indeed, listen to this sentence. It appears to be a weaker model than most. The US is just about the only country to sustain a presidential system for a long period without descending into dictatorship. Oh my God, Russ, 2015. I read that sentence and I started to vomit, because that's exactly what Tuesday feels like. Will we be able to say that we were able to be one of the only systems left to be able to go for a long period without descending into dictatorship? Because Trump is not about president.
Not fair to ask me a question like that right as we're going to the break, Arnie.
I know. We can go back. We can start back on, but just okay. A minute to sort of
give me another crack at that one.
Okay, I will give you another crack at that one. All right, do we need to go to a break now, Ken? I think we do. Let's take a break. This is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. It's our Rethink the Week. We will be right back. Welcome back to part two of the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We continue with our Rethink the Week panel. We have Rick Newman, a former state legislator from New Hampshire, currently a lobbyist in the New Hampshire House and Senate. Welcome back, Rick. We have also joining us Russ Muirhead. He is running for the state legislature in New Hampshire, but he also happens to have another real job, and that is he is the chair of the government department at Dartmouth College. We have Ron Abramson. He is an immigration lawyer from New Hampshire, and Dean Spiliotis, a civic scholar and a presidential scholar from Southern New Hampshire University. So I did a bad thing right before the break. I read something incredibly provocative and I tossed it to Russ. So let me sort of again read the provocative statement, because this was written in 2015. And the question was asked, which country in the world had sort of the best electoral voting system? And they had chosen New Zealand as the best. But then they pointed out that in America, we kind of stoke ourselves and think that we are just so phenomenal. And what the writer wrote was, indeed, it appears to be a weaker model, referring to the US, than most. The US is just about the only country to sustain a presidential system for a long period without descending into dictatorship. Oh my goodness, how prescient, Russ Muirhead, because that's really what Tuesday feels like. It's not a choice of Republican or Democrat or which candidate will win. It's whether we actually have something that more resembles a despot than someone that resembles a president.
The rock bottom core of democracy is the willingness of people in power to walk away peacefully when they lose an election. And the first time that was ever done was when John Adams, poor old John, loses an election to Thomas Jefferson in 1800. He walks away. He says, here are the keys, take it. He is not happy. And that it takes another almost 30 years before it happens again in American politics. And it's the poor guy's son, John Quincy, loses to Andrew Jackson. He's no happier than his father was, but he walks away after one term, says, here you go, I'm out. And that is what makes democracy work. When George Herbert Walker Bush walks away and says to Bill Clinton, as graciously as a human being possibly could, here you go, sir, good luck, I'm behind you 100%. He did a greater service to constitutional democracy than anything he did while he was president. It was an extraordinary act, and we don't give people credit for it. This guy is suggesting he won't walk away. And it's the first time an American president has suggested anything like that since, I mean, no American president has ever suggested it, but since, you know, 1800, it was done for the first time. So this is something new. And as you say, it's chilling. And the other thing, I mean, the second thing that makes democracy work, and here we're down to just the core basics. I'm not even talking about what makes democracy excellent, just work in the core sense. It's that you look across at the people you're fighting with as opponents whom you can engage respectfully and peacefully. And when you're in power, you treat them with respect and you listen. You don't lock them up. You don't send them to the tower. You don't prosecute them. You don't use the law enforcement personnel of the state to prosecute them. And I mean, this too is without this democracy, just that it'll devolve into something else. It'll devolve into violence or to authoritarianism or whatever. And to see this guy, that the chant, the slogan in his campaign, is lock him up, lock her up. Whether it's the governor of Michigan, whether it's president, whether it's Biden, whether it's Obama, whether it's Hillary, they should all be locked up. And the president is, openly encouraging this attitude, converting opponents into enemies. Democracy can't work once our opponents are enemies.
So, Ron, as I'm hearing all this and getting more terrified by the hour, I have two thoughts. One is that we are an oligarchy. I mean, the billionaires are doing incredibly well. I mean, as the pandemic rages, there are billions in Greece, as the lines for food, food lines increase, and there isn't a second bailout. But I am wondering if those oligarchs want Donald Trump as president. I wonder if those oligarchs are worried about their massive, massive amounts of money. Because let's take a look at Putin in Russia. How are they doing economically? Not so good. I mean, I'm looking at Xi and China, and I'm not even sure they're doing so good for some of those people who are incredibly affluent. And I'm just looking at these incredibly wealthy people who, for the most part, have been very tight-lipped during this election. I mean, there's always a handful, Adelson for Trump and Sire for Biden. But for the most part, they've sort of been sitting on the sidelines. They have to be worried about a Trump future. Biden, as progressive as Biden will be, they'll still be freaking rich after 4 years of Biden or even
eight. Wait, sorry. Biden's going to be progressive now?
Oh, no.
That sounds great.
All right. No, but I'm kind of curious about the money counters and the Wall Street boys and the oligarchs, because in the end, they don't want this result. And yet they may end up with this result. And all their billions will have been for naught.
Well, the clear illustrative example right now is Michael Bloomberg, because he's been putting his money where his mouth is. And didn't he just shift $100 million into Florida to go on an ad blitz? And it seems like there are a handful of people, and it's been a while. My oligarch friends and I are not in regular touch these days, but it's been a while since anybody's really just put this together and said, I mean, one person, Bloomberg could have put $10 billion into this election and it would not impact his standard of living, his standing. There would be no noticeable impact to the way he lives his life. But the only thing I can come back to is at that point, money is just keeping score. It's not about anything. It's not about buying more. It's not about, I mean, maybe it's about having more influence and more power. But even the fact that the Trump campaign seems to be hurting for money and they don't have this well to tap into at the end tells you a lot about which way that wind is blowing.
Okay, so I'm going to stop you there because, Dean, let's go back to 2015 and 2016. Donald Trump didn't need money. He got more free media than any human being on the planet. How many billions did he get in free media? Remember when you used to have to show up for Face the Nation? Remember when you have to show up for these things? He could dial in. So money and Trump has no meaning because he can manipulate the media because he's got Fox News. He's got Rush Limbaugh. He's got a lot of Facebook pages. He's got the complaint from Ron just before about the New York Times. You know, look at how they frame the stories about Donald Trump. Do they say that he's a lying SOB? Do they say that that's not what is appropriate, that you don't get to choose whether you won or not? So I'm not worried about the money being spent. I'm just sort of confused why the oligarchs, these incredibly wealthy people, would somehow not want to sort of control this outcome, because it's not about their money being spent. It's about the man that might ultimately control this country. And that can't be good for them. But I see the handwriting on the wall. Just before the election of Donald Trump in 2016, I know a bunch of very wealthy people in New York who knew Donald Trump very well. And they were all calling me up the night before the election going, he can't win, can he? He can't win, can he? He, you know, he's a liar. He's a thief. He's a this, he's a that. I said, really? And where was your voice? Where were you telling us that story? Since you had personal experiences with him in the business world, in the real estate world, in the casino world. And now you're looking at me and saying he can't win. I think the story of Donald Trump is the story of a lot of people looking the other way and basically giving him a license to lie and steal and cheat. And that happened before 2016. And it looks like it's going to continue if he wins after 2020.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I think to some extent, the certainly the technology oligarchy, whether you're talking about Twitter or Facebook or even Amazon, you know, those folks are basically just looking to be left alone for the most part and not come under the microscope with the congressional oversight. And so I think they will kind of do whatever they need to do to maximize their you know, freedom to make a profit and expand their businesses. I remember in 2016 you were quite exercised about the free media, the earned media that Trump was getting, going back when MSNBC would run a 2-hour town hall, interrupt all their programming and just let him go for exactly 2 hours at a pop. It was remarkable. You know, in some sense, the same thing is happening. I mean, he always is the story. I mean, now he has the added benefit of being the president, which always makes you the story. But I saw, I think it was last week, an article that said that the top 10 most frequently accessed links on Facebook were all people from Trump world, all columnists and opinion writers from the Trump information ecosystem. So, I mean, that's just kind of the reality of the situation. It's a different, it's a different time. I often tell my students, you know, when I was growing up in the 60s and 70s, you know, we had 6 or 7 TV channels, and everybody had the same six or seven channels on their TV with the rabbit ears. And so there was some sort of at least the basis for a common discussion. And we don't really have that anymore. People live in different information ecosystems that are siloed from each other. And they never meet. And so this adds into our earlier discussion of the Trump's faithful do genuinely believe that he will win. And if he does not win, it's because the election was rigged against him in some way, because that's what they hear in their particular information ecosystem, and nothing penetrates that bubble.
And so, Rick, I want to go back to something that Russ said and also sort of touch on what Dean said. And so I'm looking at the surge in early voting, which is incredible. I mean, never have we seen so many people vote. Look at Texas. Texas has, I mean, we do a show every Friday with a guy named Scott Braddock, who's just a phenomenal reporter from Texas. And that everyone thinks that, you know, the Texas is a Republican state. Texas is actually a Republican state that doesn't allow voting. So it's a non-voting state. They have done everything to make it very difficult to exercise the franchise. But for whatever reason, people are crawling around and over and behind, and they are exercising the franchise. And we've seen an incredible surge. The reason I get worried about what Dean said about the base of the Donald Trump's base is that we don't teach civics anymore. So who's been teaching the civics lesson to the Republican GOP Trump base is Donald Trump. So when Donald Trump basically says it has to be rigged in order for me to lose, they believe it because they don't actually have a real handle on this voting thing. They don't have a real handle on how you make these choices. They don't have a real handle on how this process works. So their teacher is the most effective lying SOB who doesn't believe in the process anyway, and he's manipulating them because they are not steeped in an understanding of governing, of policy, or of civics. Rick.
Well, you know, I think that's a fair point, but I also think it's like, you know, if you go to a comedy show, you go there because you want to laugh. And so even if the guy or woman is not very good, you spend the evening laughing because that's what you wanted to hear. And in a lot of cases, I think when you talk about people's lack of civics, I think there was, and it probably, well, there is a general distrust among a lot of people in government in general. Trump gets up there and says, hey, I'm with you. I hate government, too. And then they say, hey, he's our guy. So they're right about the fact that what they know about civics, in a sense, they're getting from listening to the person that's telling them what they want to hear. Yeah. Now, the question is going to be on Tuesday. What are those people? Who are those people that came out? You're right. Texas has exceeded 2016 already. Hawaii has exceeded 2016. Hawaii, not really much of a state that's in doubt in terms of how it's going to vote. But there are four or five other states that are already at 80% of 2016. Nationally, I believe we're at about 67, 68% of the vote cast in 2016. So, you know, what is going to happen? One more thing about Trump, people listening to him, I just want to let you know that breaking news, the Tappan Zee Bridge has now been shut down by Trump supporters. It's now called the Mario Cuomo Bridge, but the Tappan Zee Bridge that separates New Jersey goes over the Hudson River to White Plains has now been shut down literally right now at 4:45.
So will Trump tweet out, I love those people that are stopping New York and New Jersey. I mean, remember, he's not a resident anymore. He's now a resident of Florida, everyone. So there is no more allegiance there, although I think he still has a couple of casinos and a couple of buildings in New York, so he should be a little bit pissed off. So,
you know, if those guys just turn south from the Tappan Zee Bridge, they can be in New York City and take that over in 20 minutes.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. So, Russ, here's the thing that really makes me crazy. I saw a headline in one of the New Hampshire papers, and it was from the attorney general, who said, you know we're an open carry state, but I really wouldn't encourage you to go to the voting place with your weapon on you, strapped on you in order to vote. I can't stop you, but I don't think this is a good idea. And he says, now, of course, if someone thinks that they're if someone is intimidated by your actions, we can, of course, look into this and maybe we will prosecute. So here's my question, Russ. What does intimidation look like when the guy behind me is wearing a red hat, carrying an AK, whatever he's carrying with his open carry? He knows who I am, a liberal Democrat, and I might be standing in line in front of him. And I see the gun and I see him. Do I have a right to feel intimidated? Can I call the AG right there? What does he have to do to make me feel intimidated? Does he have to shoot me? Does he have to cock his weapon at me? Remember, this isn't just about open carry. It's open carry with bullets in your open carry. All right, you're armed. So what is scary for me is that you're looking at Michigan, you're looking at New Hampshire. A lot of states have this ability. I am armed with a pencil and they have a weapon. Tell me how you define intimidation, and how is that not intimidation just by their mere presence?
Sarah, I've talked to some authorities in some towns in the state of New Hampshire who heard this, that consider anyone whose gun is visible as constituting intimidation, and they will ask such a person to leave. So I think some towns are simply not going to let this happen. But the real thing is that what we have is a public authority whose voice is broadcast to hundreds of thousands of people, and who's not taking any care to ensure that tiny fraction of the population that's perhaps doesn't always keep its equilibrium, its mental equilibrium, that tiny fraction is, they're taking no care to make sure that tiny fraction is not activated in ways that endangers the larger public. And that's always the problem. You know, something like Pizzagate, most people think of it's nuts. Edgar Welch shows up at the pizzeria with an assault rifle and fires it. And so this is the thing, the Attorney General's voice was heard by people who are now going to make it their business to go out there and test the limits of this. And, you know, this is not just going to be a spectacle. I mean, this could end with violence. And it's a total abdication of one's responsibility, you know, as a public figure, as an official. And, all I can say is I think I trust the town authorities to be a lot more sensible than our Republican officials are.
I'm going to, Ron, because the problem is going to be the town authorities don't have the authority to stop these people from exercising the franchise with their open carry weapon. And what you're asking town authorities to do is to put their lives at risk, because if this does trigger anything, now remember, you also don't have to wear a mask in order to vote. So even if you have a town that has a mask mandate, for the purposes of voting, you cannot require someone to be wearing a mask to vote. So can you imagine someone seeing someone with an open carry, not wearing a mask, coming into a setting where you want people to socially distance, you want to protect your poll workers, and they are doing everything just by their physical presence to intimidate them, both physically from carrying the weapon and then medically from not wearing a mask. Talk about the most frightening situation for towns around New Hampshire.
Oh, it's an unspeakable, like I say, it's an unspeakable betrayal of the Attorney General's, you know, responsibility as the chief law enforcement officer. And you know, listen, I've heard that the Firefighters Union is going to be at polling places, actually on behalf to protect them as peaceful and calm locations. I mean, off-duty firefighters. But the whole thing, I mean, just to create a scene like this and to get the worry going in the minds of voters and thus suppress the vote, it's a crime. And so, it's a betrayal of fundamental democratic norms. It's unspeakable.
So let me turn to the attorney on the panel. So Ron Abramson, I've been hearing from a lot of people who are moderators or overseers of the checklist or whatever, and they are beside themselves. They're beside themselves because they remember before we had different towns that sort of said, you know, conquer, you have to wear a mask, whatever, that a lot of business owners were intimidated and afraid, even though they might have a policy at their business, you can't come in without a mask. They had no real authority to say, you know, you can't come in here. And they were feeling threatened when they were telling people, you know, we really have this policy. And the people would say, screw you, you know, I'm coming in. And take that and now put that on steroids when you're talking about the vote, because there's so much emotion going on, especially during this election cycle.
Right. Well, there's a lot to address in there, but a couple of brief points. One is, it seems that we have reached a time where the First and Second Amendments cannot coexist, at least in terms of people being authorized to carry publicly, which will always have a chilling effect on an unarmed, otherwise peaceful person's freedom of speech, or at least feeling that they can exercise their freedom of speech, their freedom of assembly. We have seen all kinds of double standards when it comes to law enforcement's response to assembly. There were no arrests to speak of when certain militia groups occupied state houses showing their weapons. There were tear gassed marchers yesterday on their way to vote in North Carolina. Right. without a person armed in sight. You know, obviously the number one argument for being armed and being armed in public is self-defense, yet these same people won't wear a mask, which is the best self-defense against the thing that is most likely to harm them or people they care about at this time. Because it's not about any of that. It's about symbolism. It's about being told what to do. It's about political opportunism and control. And it gets filed under freedom, but it's always been well understood that our freedom ends where it harms someone else. That's the fire in a crowded theater example. You don't have unqualified constitutional rights and unqualified freedoms in this country, because if you did, it would be anarchy and it might look, I don't know, a lot like it looks right now.
Yeah, exactly. So, and I keep going back, and you've heard me say this before, Dean. So let's say there's someone carrying a weapon, okay, open carry, and I'm in front. And they have shown that once you are weaponized as an individual, whether you're carrying concealed or carrying open carry, you then sort of have this assumption that everyone around you is also weaponized because you are. So what I think the Attorney General and what Ron was saying is doesn't appreciate. So let's say I put my hand into my purse to pull something out. And the assumption is, because there's already an agitation, because they know who I am and they know who, the assumption is that I am pulling something out that's probably not a pen, all right? And that's what we are creating on this Tuesday around the country, is that people are coming in with a certain headset. It's kind of like when you're carrying a hammer, everything looks like a nail, all right? Well, that's the problem with carrying a weapon. Everyone then assumes that everybody else is weaponized. And now in a setting where we want a peaceful transfer of power, we are creating the most unpeaceful way of exercising the franchise. And it's being protected by the Attorney General. It's being encouraged by Donald Trump. All these things are happening. And I don't know how you sustain a democracy when you created this kind of toxic situation.
Yeah, you know, it is one of the great dividing lines in the polarization in our country. Think about the debates we've had just in the New Hampshire state legislature over gun control legislation, and the way that it's kind of gone back and forth depending on which party controls the state legislature. And so this is just one of those things where, you know, getting back to my earlier comment about 80% of people having concerns about violence. This is certainly part of that discussion.
Yeah.
You know, it's really up to the local officials to keep control of this. If people look the other way, it's going to be a problem. If they're firm about adhering to whatever the rules are around poll watching, et cetera, that's a different story. You know, I talk to people about this all the time, and some folks, when they see see people with open carry, whether it's just a sidearm or like complete, you know, SWAT special operator gear that some people like to dress up in when they go out in public. Some people find that threatening. Other people just find it kind of unnecessary. And we just have to hope that I'm sure there are going to be some situations where it'll be tense. You know, my hope is that in the end, it won't be a big problem, but it is concerning that the enforcement of the kind of the procedures and rules around open carry around the country are uneven. And then you fold in, as you said, a president who is encouraging people up armed to watch what's going on.
Right. But also let me just reemphasize this here, because Donald Trump Jr. told the supporters to have fun. And his definition of fun was getting that Biden-Harris bus off the road. His definition of fun is that level of intimidation that, you know, can we call it intimidation or can we not? Understand, they call this fun. And it's not just coming out of the president. Don Jr. is saying sort of a similar thing. And he said that having fun just before we just saw what Rick Newman was saying on the New Jersey Turnpike, what happened in Texas with the bus. This is their fun. I just want everyone to understand. That's how they package it. But Rick, we only have a few minutes left and I haven't gotten to this. And the one people I feel the most depressed and frightened for are the doctors and nurses, that are going to have to be dealing with this incredible, incredible spike in COVID-19. But what is just more amazing is Trump's claim that doctors inflate COVID numbers so they can make money. Understand what he did. He also put a target on the back of doctors, not just with his COVID-19 denial, but the idea that they're doing this to basically enhance their financial portfolio, Rick.
Yeah, and that has been a conspiracy theory running around the internet for about 4 or 5 weeks, which tells you where this guy gets his information. I mean, it is the most disturbing thing aspect, I think, if you could just pick one, and there's so many. But, you know, Donald Trump, as president of the United States, has access to the best information in any subject matter that exists. And he chooses to quote something coming from a conspiracy theory. I first heard that comment 4 weeks ago from a person who I know to be a QAnon supporter, who told me that, oh, no, this is a fact. Doctors, if they put it down, they get $4,000 extra for putting down COVID as the reason people die. I mean, it's ridiculous beyond the point of being ridiculous. But then when I saw Trump quote that, I thought to myself, my God, what kind of foolishness is this?
And on that note, I have to end with the foolishness. And I want to remind everyone that on Tuesday night, the candidate does not get to declare who wins or loses. That is not the province of the candidate. Let me thank
Ernie. Texas is where the action is.
I know.
Our listeners in Texas, we need you.
You got it. Russ Muirhead is from Dartmouth College.
No matter what.
Right, Rick Newman, a lobby of Steve Spiliotis is from Southern New Hampshire University, and Ron Abramson is a fabulous immigration lawyer. Thank you, gentlemen, so much for just an incredibly interesting panel. And the next time that we pull this together, things will be quite different. Thank you so much. This is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We'll schmooze tomorrow. Ciao.